You are listening to a sermon by Veronica Dick, recorded on Sunday, June 27th, 2023 at Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia.
The opinions expressed by the speakers are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgrmf.org.
Good morning, everybody. So, the story we will be looking at today is a very familiar one. It is part of a three-chapter narrative focusing on the prophet Elijah. And our story follows immediately one of the most famous confrontations recorded in the Bible, that between the prophets of Baal and the prophet of Yahweh. A severe drought lasting 3 years has caused hardship in the land. Elijah announces a contest in chapter 18, where the Baal prophets prayed and shouted for fire to come down from heaven on sacrificial bulls, even resorting to mutilating themselves, but ending in complete failure. Elijah, being a bit of a showman, even ups the ante by soaking the altars in water and comes out triumphant for the cause of Yahweh, being the only true God who has the power to end the drought which has afflicted the people. Yet in the next breath, Elijah is fleeing for his life. And just a word for those of you who heard Laura's reflections last Sunday, I want to warn you that our topic today is on a very different place on the emotional spectrum. Last week, we were encouraged with the gifts of glimmers of joy. Today's reading is looking at someone who is frightened, burnt out, depressed, and possibly suicidal. Nonetheless, we can draw from scriptures the lesson of God's provision for our physical, emotional, and spiritual needs. This story asks us to recognize that our lonely or painful time in the wilderness prepares us for renewed vision and mission. Jonathan read the passage for us a short while ago, and before we look more closely at our text, I just want to give some background and context to our scripture. The two books of Kings were originally one book, which continued the story of the monarchy, which began in 1 and 2 Samuel. Some kings are judged as good, others not so good. The account is considered part of the theological history genre. So when we hear the word history, we likely presuppose certain notions, that the events are true, they happened in real time, and they are reliable. And while it might be the case that in places the chronology is confused, this does not take away the reliability and value of what the author or redactor wants to communicate. The scriptures present the encounter between Yahweh and Elijah as unique historically and literarily. The life and ministry of Elijah is probably set in the most tumultuous period in the Hebrew Bible history. There has been a significant shift in Israel's monarchy from David to Solomon, and then the rebellion under Solomon's son Rehoboam, which leads to a split in the kingdom. There are now two kingdoms, Israel, led by Jeroboam, and Judah with Rehoboam as its king. From this point on, chaos, change, and unfaithfulness characterize the monarchy of both. Now, we don't have an account of the call of Elijah, as we do some other prophets. Rather, we are abruptly introduced to him in chapter 17, where he announces to King Ahab that a drought will come. King Ahab and his court were involved in the worship of the god Baal, who in Canaanite mythology was responsible for providing rain. Elijah acts like a lawyer for the covenant, confronting Ahab on the abandonment of the Lord's commands, and calls the king and the people back to faithfulness to Yahweh's covenant. The crowning moment in chapter 18 is the contest between Baal and Yahweh, where the followers of Baal are utterly humiliated. There isn't time to look at the details of this three-chapter set, which has many narrative parallels as a whole and within each chapter. But in short, while we will look at some structural patterns in chapter 19, all leads to a key moment in our particular passage where Elijah encounters Yahweh at Mount Horeb. Now, Mount Horeb is actually another name for Mount Sinai. And indeed, the connection with Moses and the Exodus story here is not accidental. There are a number of narrative elements which allude to Israelite history and the experiences of Moses and put our story of Elijah here into a larger context, including the Exodus and the wilderness wanderings. I mean, there's the history and geography of Israel itself as being the setting. There is an encounter with Yahweh that is set on a mountain. There is the standing on a rock and hiding in a cave. There's the 40 days and the 40 nights. The same Hebrew verb agar is used to describe God passing by, and similar theophanies of God, including fire and earthquake. And I just want to say, I'm using this word theophany throughout the talk, and it simply means a visible manifestation to humankind of God. So we're going to take a closer look at the text itself, starting in verse 1. Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah, saying, "So may the gods do to me and more also, if I do not make your life like the life of one of them by this time tomorrow." It's interesting to note, God did not actually command Elijah to kill all the priests of Baal. If God wanted them dead, God could have incinerated them along with the bulls on the altar. God gave Elijah a very simple command: go and present yourself to Ahab. I will send rain on the earth. That's it. All he had to do was declare God's end to the drought. But Elijah's zeal got the better of him, and he had to escape the consequences of his murders when Jezebel promised revenge. Verse 3. Then he was afraid. He got up and fled for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah. He left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a solitary broom tree. He asked that he might die. "It is enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am no better than my ancestors." What's happened to our fierce and bold prophet who did not hesitate to stand up to the king and the prophets of Baal? Once Elijah reached Beersheba, about a distance of 200 kilometers, he was actually already safe geographically because he was now in Judah, not in Israel, and time-wise because the oath that Jezebel had sworn had expired after one day. But clearly, Elijah is not showing any signs of relief. Many commentators debate how seriously this can be seen as a suicide attempt by Elijah. Whether it is or not, no one can survive the harsh conditions, the desert conditions of the Sinai. The irony is glaring. Elijah refused to surrender to Jezebel, but now asks God to take his life. The ancestors, or some translations have fathers, are probably understood to be the prophetic predecessors who also struggled and failed to encourage the Israelites to be faithful. verse 5. Then he lay down under the broom tree and fell asleep. Suddenly, an angel touched him and said to him, "Get up and eat." He looked, and there at his head was a cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. He ate and drank and lay down again. Sleep is a common byproduct of depression, and metaphorically it can denote death. But God is not giving up on the prophet. The translation uses the word angel, but the Hebrew term malak is more basic, and it just means messenger. But this is the same word used when Jezebel sent a messenger to deliver her death threat. So there's some narrative tension created until the text clarifies that this messenger is from God. And there are some other significant or unique words used here. The only other place in the Hebrew Bible where the word for hot stones or coal, resapim, is used is Isaiah 6, verse 6, referring to the coal that touches Isaiah's lips to purify him. And the prophet expresses dismay at not being able to accept God's call. The word for jar, Safat, is also not common and is used just a couple of chapters back when the jar of the widow Zarephath remains miraculously full during the drought, nourishing herself and Elijah. Verse 7. The angel of the Lord came a second time, touched him and said, "Get up and eat. Otherwise, the journey will be too much for you." He got up and ate and drank. Then he went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the Mount of God. The angel comes a second time, but this time explains why it's important for Elijah to eat and drink, or the journey will be too much for you. But there's some action words here: getting up, eating, drinking. And they are signs that at least some energy has returned to Elijah. And verse 8 makes some compelling links to Elijah being like a second Moses. He makes a pilgrimage to Sinai, where Moses received the call. There's the 40 days and 40 nights connected to the two sojourns of Moses on Sinai. And Sinai is forever associated with an Israelite tradition of covenant making, God's revelation of the Torah, and the construction of the tabernacle, the earthly dwelling place of Yahweh. Along with providing life-giving food and water, this pilgrimage is deeply connected to the essentials of the Hebrew faith. And verse 9, at that place, he came to a cave and spent the night there. Then the word of the Lord came to him saying, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" "Here, in a cave, in the wilderness, hiding, not out in the world carrying out the work of God as prophets are called to do." I mean, it's not a bad thing to make a pilgrimage to the place of the source of one's faith, but Elijah's response is to complain with self-absorbed whining. He answered, "I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the Israelites have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they are seeking my life to take it away." Elijah's memory is a little selective at this point. He's exaggerating the negative and overlooking the success we witnessed in the previous chapter. Some defend Elijah as demonstrating classic burnout, which leads to pessimism and exaggerated self-importance. But God doesn't respond to Elijah's self-indulgence and complaint. In the next verse, he said, "Go out and stand on the mountain before the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by." Now there was a great wind so strong that it was splitting mountains and breaking rocks in pieces before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. Again, we hear the allusion to Moses and the Exodus events. There are three dramatic nature events, but the text states that Yahweh was not in any of them. The elements of wind, earthquake, and fire were the purview of Baal in Canaanite myth. But Yahweh is not using this display to show God's power over an idol. God is trying to get Elijah's attention so he will listen to what follows next. And after the fire, a sound of sheer silence. The translation of the Hebrew, which our NRSV renders as sheer silence, has received a lot of attention, and there are multiple attempts to communicate the sense of the original. The word kol means sound or voice. The first adjective, demama, suggests quietness, stillness, or silence. And the second adjective, daka, means something that has been made fine or thin. So a survey of translations into English include gentle whisper, pounding silence, deafening silence, still small voice. One writer notes that in the Aramaic Targum, the image of God here is as Lord of hosts, and the Aramaic means the voice of those who were praising softly. I really like that phrase. Verse 13. When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. Then there came a voice to him that said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He answered, "I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the Israelites have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they are seeking my life to take it away." Not one word has changed in Elijah's response when God asks again, "What are you doing here?" With all these echoes of Moses, the reader might expect Elijah to mount a Moses-like defense of the people, but instead, he repeats his account of the people's guilt. The mantle was seen as a symbol of the prophetic office. When Moses concealed his face, it was to protect the people who might fear his changed appearance. When Elijah covers his face, he does so out of fear and respect of God's presence, but speaks harshly against the people. The rest of the chapter. Then the Lord said to him, "Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. When you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael as king over Aram. Also, you shall anoint Jehu, son of Nimshi, as king over Israel. And you shall anoint Elisha, son of Shaphat of Abdamaloha, as prophet in your place. Whoever escapes from the sword of Hazael, Jehu shall kill. And whoever escapes from the sword of Jehu, Elisha shall kill. Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him." The listener expects Yahweh to rebuke Elijah. "Have you learned nothing?" But again, God does not respond directly to Elijah's complaint. Instead, he commissions Elijah to a new task back where he came from. Instead of letting Elijah resign, his eventual successor, Elisha, is named. The violence of Israel is addressed by appointing military allies. And to counter Elijah's claims to be alone, God points out there are still thousands of faithful in Israel. Christine, you can get ready. So what is the purpose of this text? If we notice certain patterns in the text, it becomes very clear that the climax of 1 Kings 17 to 19, and indeed our passage today, is the theological point that God arrives. So here's one of the Zoom benefits that we have, since our church doesn't use PowerPoints regularly. I just thought I could throw this up on the screen so that you can visually see the pattern that is in the text. It's called a chiasm. So there are, you can see I've color-coded how different phrases or themes repeat into from the outside into the center. Elijah flees the world, his renewal begins, the question, what are you doing here, Elijah? And Elijah's told to go and stand. And then the center, which is always considered the climax, the point, the lesson, is that Yahweh passes by, and then we do the reverse direction with repeating patterns going outward again. So we have A and A1, B and B1, C, D, and the center, Yahweh passes by. Thanks, Christine. You can remove that now. Thanks. So, as I mentioned, the repetition in the first part and the second is most obvious in the question God poses Elijah. What are you doing here? But if we move out to the contrast between a fearful prophet fleeing and the end, where Elijah returns to his prophetic ministry, we see the centerpiece of this framework is the play between the presence and the absence of God. Yahweh passes by. The opposite of Yahweh is not Baal, it is the absence of Yahweh. The summit contest at Mount Carmel hinges on the absence of Baal and the presence of Yahweh. The Horeb theophany underlines the presence of Yahweh in the voice and God's absence in the wind, earthquake, and fire. In order for Elijah to renew his prophetic call, to be recommissioned, as it were, it requires an appearance of God to Elijah in the deafening silence. It is not the silence, however, that tells Elijah his instructions. It is what follows, a dialogue which leads to the new affirmation of the prophet's task and an immediate plan of action. How God appears and speaks to the prophet and how Elijah responds is not a matter of biography, but theology. The focus of the text is the covenant and revelation. When Israel turns away from God, the prophets of God withdraw. Before they return, they need to be fortified by a theophany, a dialogue with God, and a renewed sense of mission. So what about us as individuals and as a congregation? What can we draw from this story to sustain us in our lives and in our ministries? I would venture that many of us have experienced periods of being in the wilderness. And most times, it is not by choice, but a push. We are not in control. And whether there is noise or quiet, the sound that is missing is the voice of God. And we need to remember that feeling good and being happy are not always good measures of commitment to God. And on the flip side, feeling depressed, discouraged, anxious, and doubtful are not necessarily signs of spiritual relapse. In the Bible, being in the wilderness is the scene of encountering the divine. Hagar and Ishmael, Israel wandering 40 years, Jesus spending 40 days in the wilderness immediately after the high point of his baptism and God's declaration, "This is my son, the beloved." The wilderness is a place of unknowing, where the old ways no longer work, and the next thing has not yet been revealed. To be willing to be in such a place, even if uncomfortable and having no quick answers, can be freeing. Trusting God to meet us, to be open to the Holy Presence, to rest, sleep, and let go of our sense of success or failure, help us to be available for what comes next. The promise is not merely that God will always be there to encourage those who are discouraged and afraid, although it is that as well. But the promise is that Yahweh is in control and that God will defeat Baal. As we discern what might be next, we gather our memories of how God has called us in the past and what God has already done for us, our communities, our church. Even the most committed follower of God may experience discouragement and a desire to withdraw from their calling. Here, we see a possible way forward and find a new energy and a new vision and a new purpose to eat and drink of God's life-giving sustenance, return to the foundations of our faith, and listen for God's still small voice. I think that Point Grey Church is on the brink of returning from the wilderness. Our beginnings 37 years ago focused on ministry to and with students, which has changed and evolved as our demographics change, but which continue to nurture dialogue and a style of worship different from many other congregations. We have welcomed seekers and have found a significant ministry in welcoming newcomers to Canada through the food bank and refugee support. However, in some sense, when we lost our Menno Simons home and the pandemic forced us to adapt to a non-physical worship space, we were driven into a kind of wilderness that was not our choosing. We have been in an in-between time, and we ask, where is the still voice of God in our wilderness? What conversations do we need to have to renew our energy for God's work and to be open to a new call, a new direction, a new ministry? So much is still unknown, but we know we can't stay on the mountaintop, that we belong in the world, trusting God to meet us here where we are. The text today asks us to recognize that our lonely or painful time in the wilderness prepares us for renewed vision and mission. So I ask again, as we were challenged in the Friday email, where is God pushing our congregation next? Amen.